From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Philippe Gelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is CBS Radio Contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court were held this week in the U.S. Senate. The proceedings were marked by partisan rancor over process and procedures for thousands of documents pertaining to the hearings, pointed questions about the nominee's views on key issues, and an unprecedented number of protests from spectators inside the hearing room. U.S. President Donald Trump faced more scrutiny as a new book by famed political reporter Bob Woodward and an anonymous opinion piece by a quote-unquote senior official in the Trump administration, published in the New York Times, portrayed an angry and erratic president and a White House in chaos and even rebellion. And the leaders of the top social media companies testified in the U.S. Congress about how they are working to protect their platforms from election meddling, political bias, and other forms of abuse. So, gentlemen, a lot to cover, as always. And we'll start with the Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Brett Kavanaugh and the Senate Judiciary Committee. At one point, this was rather a staid and sort of boring sort of glacial pace type of thing, confirming a Supreme Court justice, which is not the case anymore. We've seen a lot of fireworks in that room. The topics I want to cover, and I'm going to give you this up front, are the questioning of the candidate on the key issues, the handling of the documents, the level of protest, and sort of the atmosphere in the room as well. But I just want to start with you, Tom, as I believe I call you our resident historian here on Voice of America. Simple question. You ever seen anything like this?
No. And I must say, I hate to sometimes remind listeners of how long I've been doing this, but as a intern for Newsweek magazine 50 years ago, in the summer of 1968, I was sent up to Capitol Hill to cover a confirmation hearing for Justice Abe Fortas, who was one of President Lyndon Johnson's closest friends from Texas. Fortas was on the court. Johnson wanted to elevate him to the Supreme Court, and the Republicans would have nothing to do with that. Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina led the charge, and ultimately Fortas had to withdraw. But so I've seen a few of these things. This is not my first Supreme Court rodeo, so to speak. But this is this I think is, I agree with you, Michael. This one is right up there. First of all, there was more protests than usual, and I'll talk about that. I think all of this has become a sideshow. It's very unlikely that Kavanaugh will not be confirmed. There's no evidence that a handful of centrist Republicans are going to buck the White House on this. They don't want to be blamed the next time they're up for reelection. And so the Republicans have a two-vote majority in the Senate, and it's very unlikely that any Republican senator will vote against Judge Kavanaugh. So he'll probably be a justice of the Supreme Court by October.
And it used to be the situation where you needed 60 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice. That has gone the way of the dinosaur, and we now only need a majority, which there's a very clear Republican majority, as you just alluded to. Philippe, talk a little bit about why all the contentiousness on the committee. Before the nominee had even been asked a single question, there were fireworks about this process of the documents and the number of documents and when they were delivered to committee members prior to the hearings. Can you just give an outline of what that was about?
Well, the stakes are very high. The next member of the Supreme Court will be the deciding vote on a lot of issues. So obviously, for the Democrats, the stakes are very high.
Right.
But on the other hand, they don't have a lot of means, as Tom mentioned. They have lost the filibuster, partly they have themselves to blame for that.
Right. Because Harry Reid took away the filibuster
exactly
for federal court appointees
in 2013.
Exactly.
And the Republicans just went along
extended that to
exactly
the Supreme Court
to all judicial nominees. So there is a lot of shouting because there are very few political concrete means to block this judicial candidate. One of the arguments of the Democrats is that they got only 10% of his record. The Republicans' counterpoint is that they got more papers, 500,000 pages, for this candidate than for the last five combined. The thing is that this gentleman, Kavanaugh, has been a political operative in the White House under Bush. And so, especially when he was staff secretary, every paper in the White House would go through his desk before reaching the desk of the president.
So there are thousands and thousands of documents that this man has touched. So is it a reasonable... Were the Democratic demands reasonable to have all of these documents?
Well, I don't think they are entirely. It seems to me that a lot of people are playing games there. They know they cannot stop this nomination. They also know that the stakes are very high once again and that they have to make their point in the eyes of the American public. And it is important to do.
To do. I agree.
But there is a lot of show and a lot of politics behind this. I mean, when you see Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey or Kamala Harris from California, it's clear that they are already using this as a platform to launch a presidential bid in 2020.
Yeah, there is a lot of kabuki theater going on in this room. I totally agree with that. Tom, let's talk about the candidate. This is supposed to be about the person in front of the dais, not the people sitting behind it. How is the candidate, Brett Kavanaugh, actually doing, especially when we talk about the key issues of answering questions on gun control, women's right to choose abortion, and presidential power and the power of the president to pardon himself and things like this?
Well, he's carefully skirting substantive answers on any of those things. He's following the time-honored playbook of Supreme Court nominees, Democratic and Republicans. And the playbook says, dodge and weave, never telegraph how you're going to vote on a case that might come before you if you're confirmed. Don't show much leg to put it another way. Kavanaugh has done that. I mean, there's a little selective amnesia here. There's a lot of not recalling various things, but that's the price you have to pay in this day and age. You don't want to give the opposition too much ammunition to say he told us he's going to be the fifth vote to overturn abortion rights. He hasn't done that. He's tried to suggest just the opposite, and so he's managing to negotiate the problems here, and he's done it reasonably well. He has been evasive, not egregiously evasive, but he has been evasive.
Has he been untruthful? Because there are documents that have been released, I guess you could say, quote unquote, illegally or improperly by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee that show that he has contradicted himself in terms of being in places and having conversations where he said that he wasn't participating in procedures where he clearly did. Has he been actually disingenuous in some of his answers? And is that something that can latch on and cause a flip of some of those key Republican votes?
Well, he's probably played a little fast and loose with his memory. As I said, you know, one of the real problems in Washington is all these brilliant people, and he is certainly a brilliant person.
He certainly is.
And well qualified academically and intellectually. Powerful people in Washington succumb to amnesia more than any other people in our country. They just can never remember things. They don't recall. I mean, as White House staff secretary, it's inconceivable, as he has suggested, that he really had no opinions about some of these controversial issues when he was in the Bush 41 White House. And so he's not said anything that dooms him, quite the opposite, but he has not been as candid as he might have been.
I think I agree with both of you when you say it's pretty much a fait accompli in terms of this, if I may use a French term.
Well, the result is a pretty boring show all day long on live TV, frankly. to listen to someone who doesn't want to answer any question, because basically that's what he's doing. I disagree a little bit with Tom. I think he's very... He goes further than, for instance, Neil Gorsuch, the previous Trump nominee, who blamed the president for his attacks on the judiciary. And even that, Brett Kavanaugh wouldn't dare say anything about that. So I think it's theatrics. It's but... As a foreign observer, I really wonder what's the point.
I'm sort of wondering that myself. I was just disappointed, and I'll go back to the atmosphere in the room. Over 200 sort of unsolicited protests, or spontaneous protests, or whatever you want to call them, outbursts in the room. It's kind of disappointing to see that people would use the opportunity in that way. I know that freedom of speech is a right, but it's... There, at some point, I think it sort of demeaned the decorum of
Well,
the,
I agree with that, Michael. But politically, it's also not smart for the Democrats or for people or for the demonstrators. It's just not the way to go. But the stakes are so high here. I believe that Kavanaugh will be confirmed. I believe he will be a very reliable fifth vote on many, many items. Very, many things that are very, very critical to the Trump Republican base, who have this adoration of social issues. I think Kavanaugh will be very sympathetic to presidential power, to social issues, to what some have called planks of culture wars, all those things.
So, with that, we'll take a break and we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castillo. Now back to our panel. Philippe Jelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
I want to move along to yet another week of controversy and commentary about the Trump White House, not only what it does, but how it does it. Bob Woodward, famed journalist Bob Woodward, I think everybody around this table has a lot of respect for what that guy has done in his career. I know that I do. He has a new book called Fear, about the inner workings of the White House and the administration, that gives a very unflattering view of President Trump and the administration as a whole. In the same week, within the same day, perhaps, a senior official in the Trump administration, self-described senior official, wrote a remarkable opinion piece that was published in the New York Times without attribution. That was a blistering critique, anonymously, a blistering critique of the president, and asserted that the writer and others in the administration were part of a resistance inside the administration that keeps the government from falling victim to the moods and impulses of the president. I'm going to start with you, Philippe, but just quickly, Bob Woodward, why is this book different? There have been a bunch of books now already about the White House. Why is this one different because it's Bob Woodward?
It's different because it's much harder to undermine the credibility of this reporter, and because the way he's been working, the way he tapes every interview that he makes, when Bob Woodward stands by his reporting, which he's been answering to the critics so far, of course, I mean, the Donald Trump himself, back in 2013, when Woodward published another book on Barack Obama, Donald Trump tweeted, "There is only the Obama White House to think they can get away with attacking Bob Woodward."
Right.
And now he's doing right exactly that.
Bob Woodward, I think, is an unassailable commentator on the presidency. He's earned that right. He's earned his stripes in that way. Have you seen an advanced copy of the book, by the way, Tom?
No, I have not.
Okay. Sorry about that, because I wish that you had. I was hoping that maybe you had.
Oh, no, but I've read all the excerpts, and I think you're right. I think Woodward's credibility is hard to challenge. He's had almost 18 months to go to senior officials, current and past, of the Trump administration. And one of Woodward's great strengths is he doesn't just talk to one person. If there's a meeting, he'll find out who was in the meeting. You know, if it's seven people, he'll talk to all seven. And he's brilliant at taking a piece of information, making pieces of tiles that after he's talked to everybody, they become a mosaic and you see a picture. So his reporting is very credible. I found it ironic that Trump refused to talk to Woodward. And then after the book was about ready to be published, he called Woodward and he said, "I wish I had known about this because I would love to have talked to you. You've always been fair." Well, 2-3 days later when the book came out, Trump called it a book of total fiction.
And let's get clear about why it was called by President Trump a work of total fiction, because, again, it was a very unflattering piece. It talked about people being very critical of him, taking documents off of his desk, taking moves to undermine his desires and his policies.
Taking moves to basically ignore requests, hoping that they would go away. But to me, the most devastating part of this document, this New York Times document, is you have somebody at a high level. The Times would not have published this if they weren't convinced that this person is not at a high level.
And let's be clear, there's a lot at stake for the New York Times.
Right, exactly yeah. Right. The other thing I think is extraordinary is that these are the sorts of things that often come out 2 years later, 3 years later, 5 years later, and this is in real time. This is happening right now. So that's one of many reasons why I think this is extraordinary, and it's devastating.
I think it's devastating also because when you look at all of these pieces that you have books by a number of people now, but they all seem to be saying the same thing. You don't really have anything from anybody in the White House that's contradicting any of these things. They have a similar tone, tenor, and type of content. Even the fact that you have this this anonymous source is like the new Deep Throat. You know, Bob Woodward, his source was Deep Throat, and now this is the new Washington pastime, is trying to find out who this person is. As a journalist, Philippe, what do you think of the idea of publishing an anonymous opinion piece, no matter how senior that person is, no matter how significant what that person has to say? You work at a storied newspaper. Would you do that? Do you agree with that policy?
It's a complicated question. I'm sure there has been quite some debate in the opinion pages at the New York Times. I understand more easily how a newspaper can decide to do that on the request of the author than the author himself. As you said, I mean, it's kind of a confirmation of what we saw the previous day in Woodward's book. The content is both stunning and also pretty unsurprising, because we've been used by now to hear that.
Doesn't say anything different.
Exactly. The thing about this op-ed is that, for me, there is a contradiction between the coming out and the very purpose of the conspiracy that is described in the op-ed. Because Donald Trump has been complaining from the beginning about a conspiracy trying to undermine him. What we see there, we could call it a virtuous conspiracy. A conspiracy that is plainly stated by this author, saying we are a number of people vowing to try to make some damage control around the president, not follow up on his comments on some of his orders, trying to limit some misguided decisions to the West Wing of the White House.
And as it says, the adults in the room is how it
exactly
himself, the adults.
And so, okay, there is a conspiracy for the better of the country, supposedly, or from the part of this person. And the logic of this is to do it silently and not to speak about it. If you reach the point when you want to get out, to come out with this, it must be for a political purpose. Why now?
Yeah.
If it is not to say to the American voters, go to the polls in November, elect a Democratic House to control even more this president because we think he's dangerous, then you don't need to do it anonymously.
Tom, I'm going to finish this topic with you. What's been the reaction of the White House, the president in particular, and does this change anything as far as how they operate?
The president has been described by several of his aides as volcanic, and I'm told that's an understatement. He's beside himself, as well he might be. Yeah, this is a matter of fact, he tweeted what is going to become a celebrated tweet among scores of celebrated tweets, one-word tweet, treason, question mark. Well, it's not treason in a legal sense, but it is certainly somebody from the inside turning on the boss is quite a profound thing. I don't know who did this, but I'll tell you this. He or she is one of many people who is on the record denouncing this as baloney. I mean, that's just the way this town works.
I just want to finish up with saying that, you know, again, the president, as you say, has been volcanic in his reaction. And I think the difference between what the president is saying is a conspiracy is that and what is really happening here is the conspiracy alleged by the president is with the deep state and people that have been around for a long time. These are Trump appointees.
Right. And I would say very, very quickly that it's a plea for help from this individual for Republican members of Congress. It's almost like this individual is saying to Republicans, it's time for the sake of the country that you stand up. Now, I don't think that's going to happen until after the November 7th elections, if it happens at all. That, I think, is going to be one of the many important things to learn from this election.
I got to change the subject, and I'd love to talk about this one some more, but just one more thing we want to get on the table before we leave, and that is the social media hearings that happened this week. COO of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg, and Twitter CEO, Jack Dorsey, were in front of the House and Senate this week talking about how their social media platforms will handle issues like election meddling, abusive accounts, things like that. The hearings had a very different tenor than the confirmation hearings that are going on right down the hall. Very quickly, Tom or Philip, if you wanted to take that, did you see any of those hearings and did anything come of it in your opinion? Are these important in light of the upcoming midterms?
I think they've been under the shadow of the political events this week. What I've seen is Jack Dorsey was pretty cool in his testimony before the Congress. And, well, you know, those big tech companies, they've been playing defense for 2 years now about the Russian interference in the election. And now the game is becoming a little more political for them because they are accused by the president of political bias. Apparently, they are threatened of some sort of investigation by the Department of Justice on a basis that hasn't been substantiated so far. We don't know exactly on what ground they would be investigated. But so they are pushed to police a little more their platforms, something Twitter just did by banning Alex Jones and InfoWars permanently from its network. So things are moving a little bit. The question, the central question of should those companies be regulated by the state, by the states, because it's the right. same, the problematic is similar in Europe and elsewhere, or should they police themselves, is a really a philosophical question. And it's been on the table for a while. They have been arguing that this is not the Wild West. This is, you know, we're doing our part. I'm not so sure that we have so many examples in history of such powers able to regulate themselves appropriately.
I think I agree with you there. I think, though, if you get a chance to watch those hearings, one of my favorite moments in the history of congressional hearings takes place when Republican House Representative Billy Long, a protester, stands up and goes into a screed, and Billy Long, who's an auctioneer, does his auctioneer thing to drown out the protest. It's one of the more enjoyable things you're ever going to see in Congress. Very quickly, as we finish, I do want to say that we bid a fond farewell to someone who was not in my life, but I consider a good friend. It's Burt Reynolds, the famed actor, one of the most popular actors of the 70s, probably known as much for the roles that he did take in Smokey and the Bandit and Deliverance and Boogie Nights as for the roles that he turned down, which include James Bond, Han Solo in the Star Wars movies, and others. He turned down Die Hard, for example. A great actor, a great person, and he will be missed. That's really all the time we have for this week, unfortunately, and I do want to thank our guest Philip Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio Contributor. Thanks for listening.